Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference, or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talk to Chris and Melissa Bruntlett. They are the authors of a new book called Building the Cycling City, the Dutch Blueprint for Urban Vitality. The Bruntletts are cycling advocates and promoters of the multimodal lifestyle, which is to say that they make their way to and from all the places they need to be by using bicycles, public transit, or their own 2 feet whenever possible. They now put their thoughts on that, as well as how the rest of the world is developing multimodal transportation infrastructure, in a new book, and cycling and the joys of cycling is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Chris and Melissa Bruntlett are partners in life and in cycling promotion. Their story, as described on their website, involves them giving up their family car to embrace a car-light lifestyle. They started chronicling their efforts in writing, photos, film, and social media, but their next move is to go the old-fashioned route and put out a book. In Building the Cycling City, the Dutch Blueprint for Urban Vitality, the Bruntletts take us to the Netherlands and describe how that country has become, in their words, quote, an important model for moving the rest of the world toward a more human-scale, bike-friendly future, unquote. They look at the infrastructure and attitude towards cycling by the Dutch and point out how, despite NIMBY proclamations that it can't happen here, cities around the world have nonetheless taken lessons learned from the Dutch and applied them to their own cities. Not that it's easy, of course. One of the first acts of the new Ford government in Ontario was to cancel the Ontario Municipal Commuter Cycling Program, or OMCC, which spread $93 million to communities across the province as part of the revenue from the Cap and Trade program to improve cycling infrastructure. That was a blow to cyclists and advocates for active transportation here in Ontario, but it is an election year for municipalities, both here in our own province and in Vancouver, where the Bruntletts live. Maybe there's still a chance to change the message. So in this episode of the Guelph Politicast, I talk to Chris and Melissa Bruntlett about their own car light story, what they wanted to say in the book, and what cycling is like for people in the Netherlands who have never been. We also talk about the changing narrative on how roads are for cars, what they learned from the Dutch and how that could be transferred here in Canada, and what utopia might look like for all you hardcore cyclists out there. And obviously, we're also talking about how you can get involved and advocate for a brighter cycling tomorrow, again, seeing how this is an election year. Of course, you could also buy their book, and we will tell you how you can do that at the end of the podcast, should you so choose, because they would probably obviously appreciate it very much. So I caught up with the Bruntletts via Skype from their home in Vancouver. So Chris and Melissa Bruntlett, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure.
I wanted to start with, if you could just describe your own story in terms of, you know, people can go on your website, obviously, and read it. But in 2010, the legend goes, you guys decided to go car light. So what prompted that decision, and how do you describe car light?
Well, it was really just a confluence of events. When we first moved to Vancouver from Guelph, actually, Chris was commuting in and out of the city to Abbotsford, which is a nearby suburb, and in 2010 started working locally, and we were finding that our car was sitting pretty much unused in our garage. I was also working locally. Our kids were in daycare nearby. And so it was just one of those things where, you know, for the expense that it was to have a car and, you know, the fact that we had car share available to us in Vancouver, it made sense to try it out, try selling our car and living by bike, traveling on foot, transit, and then using car share wherever it made sense. And that's sort of where the car light definition comes in, is we don't live completely without using a car. We do use a car when it's necessary for, you know, trips to IKEA or you know, more longer haul trips, but we don't own a car. So it's more using one when we need to, as opposed to using one because it's convenient.
And that's kind of a convenience that, you know, you do find in bigger cities. I mean, even where I live, to an extent, we have public transit. We have some bike lanes. We have some trails. There is one car share. But it's very hard to go car-free if you live sort of anywhere except in the hub of major cities. So I guess my first question is, you're traveling to a lot of places, and you know a lot of places here in Ontario, where that is difficult. So I guess how do we close that gap between when taking your message to the places where you're kind of starting from the ground up? You live somewhere in Vancouver where you can sort of cast off the car. But there are places, a lot of places in Canada, where your message, you're trying to ask people to start from zero and build up to a more car-free culture.
Yeah, I think, you know, the one thing we would stress is the solution isn't to this problem isn't for everyone to move to the cities. I mean, that's already happening to a large extent, which is why a lot of city centers are becoming unaffordable. And people don't have access to all these transportation options necessarily unless they can afford, the exorbitant rents and or a mortgage to live in the city. And so the solution really is to make our suburbs more walkable, bikeable, transit friendly. And it's not a silver bullet solution, and it's not an overnight fix, but it's really, you know, weaving these options into the fabric of our cities, and perhaps that involves smarter land use decisions, not necessarily separating our where we live from where we shop, from where we work, and then when we do have to travel longer distances, to make sure that there's the frequency of accessible transit, and sometimes a car is entirely necessary. But right now we've very much built a society where to be a participant in that society, you need to own and operate an automobile, and that excludes, you know, large segments of the population that may be not old enough to get a license, or too old to drive, or just aren't interested in the burden of car ownership, or can't afford it. And so, you know, that's certainly our push, is towards a more equitable solution that brings everybody to the mobility table.
Right. So let's go into, you know, hopefully without spoiling too much from the book, and we can still encourage people to buy the book. But you're talking very specifically about the model and things you saw in the Netherlands that are encouraging to you to building better cycling infrastructure. So, you know, perhaps just generally, for people who've never been to the Netherlands and, don't know what it looks like on riding a bike there, what was your impression? And can you describe it a bit in terms of what that experience is?
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the things that we had read before we had traveled there and have certainly experienced ourselves is once you get out of the train station or like out in the city center, one of the first things you notice is really how quiet it is. And that's because there are so many people traveling around on bikes. I mean, there's still, the stats have it that, you know, the Dutch have a really high car ownership rate, much like we do here in Canada and they do in the States. But they just choose to travel more often by bike. And so the city centers and the suburbs are just so peaceful. Like, you know, what we look for going up to cottage country is what you find in the city. And the reason that it's, you know, when you start to understand why people do travel around by bike and you look around, it's because the space has been allocated accordingly. So almost every street has a separated cycle track, which is essentially either an elevated or a barriered separate track for people to ride bikes on from the street, with still providing sidewalks for people to walk adjacent to that. And I mean, it's very rare to find streets without that, or at least not with some traffic calming that makes it, that cars have to move slower and makes more space for bikes. And that was pretty much our experience in every one of the cities that we went to, you know, from Amsterdam being the largest to, I think, would Eindhoven be the smallest?
Groningen
would be the smallest city in the north. And every city is making space for that, making it a priority so that no matter what mode you choose to travel by, there's space and safe space for you to do that.
So this is a transformation that has happened in the Netherlands. This isn't something that's been ingrained. Like, they didn't skip the phase where, here in North America, we were obsessed with the car in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. This is a transformation they made and are perhaps ahead of us, just ahead of us on the curve.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the city, but generally speaking, when we started doing our research, we saw that a lot of Dutch cities kind of resisted the urge to rebuild themselves around the car like we did here in North America, and that's widening streets, creating large parking structures and surface parking, and spreading everything out so that it's so far apart. And that was a combination of kind of citizen activism, political will, but there are some exceptions and some glaring ones. Rotterdam was a city that was completely destroyed during the Second World War by the Germans, and its entire city center was leveled to the ground, and so they rebuilt themselves in this modernist image, with the tall buildings and the wide streets, and they it bears more of a resemblance to Chicago than it does any other kind of fine-grained Dutch city. But even in that instance, it after 20 or 30 years of designing around the car, the Dutch really recognized that it was a destructive pattern of development, and people were dying on the streets, and the streets were inhospitable to walking and cycling. And so they set about a course, even in their most car-centric cities, to start making them more human scale and multimodal. So that was one of the things that we heard when we came back from the Netherlands was, well, the Netherlands is different. Their cities are different. Their country's flat. We could never do that here. And we kind of wrote the book to prove that not only can we do that here, but we are doing that here. It's just, 40 to 50 years later on the timeline.
Right, because I think you talk about that in the materials for the book, that it seems to be the go-to counter argument when you're talking about importing just about anything from Europe in terms of transportation or lifestyle, things like high-speed rail, even that, places in North America are just too big, too far apart to copy the things that Europe does. So can you talk a bit, again, without giving the book away, but can you talk a bit about the things you saw in the Netherlands that have been transferred here or can be transferred here? Maybe what are a couple of examples?
Well, I think so. In terms of like physical examples, one of the things that I think has a stark opportunity in North America, particularly in relation to how spread out we are, is the bike transit model. So there, it's the bike to train and then a bike on the other side through their national bike share to take to wherever you're going. But I see an incredible opportunity in North America to, as we're starting to build out these more regional transit systems. So I'm thinking like the GO buses and GO trains in more southwestern Ontario here with TransLink, making it so people can bike from their home to a transit station that will get them to where they need to get to without having to rely on a car. That's just something that's just so fine-grained in what they do in terms of how they move around their country. And I see an amazing potential here. And we saw a few examples in our research of where that is actually coming to light is, this idea that we can remove the car as an option for commuting or just getting around if we look at a way to mix bikes with transit through, providing bike parkades at the transit stations and then providing an alternative option when they get to their destination, whether that's bike share or if it's close enough to walk, or even having car share options, like point-to-point options at the other side. But in terms of a more sort of intrinsic, like qualitative lesson, is the fact that no two Dutch cities approach their transportation planning in the same way. It's all done contextually. And so I think we get so caught up in North America and like it has to be a certain way and these are the standards and these are the rules we must follow. And they definitely have guidelines, but it's not so strict. It's basically saying this is what we recommend for a given space, but do what makes sense for your city so that you can actually make it a possible option that people will use as opposed to copying and pasting an idea and then ending up that nobody will use it because it doesn't make sense for the context where it's been built.
Right. I don't know what it's like in along the major highways in BC, but there's such a sameness in when you're traveling down the 401 in Ontario. You see the same signs, you see the same rest stops, we're at the same restaurants, and it just I think you're right about the individual aspect is that, and maybe this comes from the government too, that they set guidelines, the provincial government sets guidelines for what you can build, where you can build, how much you can build, how big roads have to be, how big buildings have to be. And what it sounds like, at least more and more from my, reporting and political experience in the political realm, is that, we sort of need cities to make more decisions for themselves and what works for them.
Yeah, and I think, the important thing to stress is, they do, while everything is contextual, they do have a very detailed manual called the CRO manual that designates the different categories of streets and what the related type of bike infrastructure should be in that scenario. But they're very much taking a network-based approach to everything they build, and with the idea being, not just a minimum grid of bicycle infrastructure, but something that's going to get people directly from A to B without having to compromise riding with traffic, going through any kind of intersection that's dangerous. The door-to-door experience is really taken into consideration, and so it's made that a 5-year-old child could cycle to school pretty comfortably, and likewise, an elderly adult feels pretty safe getting where they need to go on a bicycle, and they don't feel like they're taking their life into their own hands as we often do here in North America.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a big pull to vault is the safety factor, is that you can know your hand signals, have a bike that is in great shape, working perfectly, wearing your helmet, having your mirrors, having your reflectors, and you still can get into trouble, and it not necessarily your fault. You can still fall victim to a traffic collision, and that is something that we've seen a lot, especially in Toronto here, where there has been, nearly 100 deaths of cyclists since the mayor there declared that, there was a new initiative a few years ago to for zero cyclist deaths. That it's there's an onus not just on the cyclist, but also on people who drive too, to try and make the roads safer.
Yeah, and kind of the first principle of the CRO manual and the related sustainable safety principles that the Dutch follow in their street design is engineering, engineering, engineering. We don't focus they don't focus that so much on education and enforcement. It's about designing the streets with the acknowledgement that people make errors, and people in cars particularly, are prone to make mistakes either willingly or unwillingly, and that our streets should be designed so that a little mistake doesn't result in an injury or death. And so we very much, that is the Vision Zero idea that's starting to come across North America, but some cities are implementing it better than others, and we would hold Toronto up as a city that's failed pretty spectacularly in its attempt to engineer its streets, because when it comes down to it, that engineering requires some political will, and that's something that Toronto severely lacks.
And the point could be made, it's also going to be a will that the province lacks, because I'm sure you guys know we have a new premier here.
Yes.
And one of the new government's first actions was to cancel, because they canceled cap and trade, and one of the programs from that was money for cycling infrastructure. And so, it's fascinating to hear you talk about the Netherlands as a place where they put the onus on engineering and not law enforcement, or not necessarily in creating new laws to better enforce the laws that are on the books. but I feel like this is something, in terms of changing that thinking, it really is a matter of changing thinking, because the money's going to be spent either way, either on enforcement, either on, you know, making roads that are, you know, sort of better for all people who use the roads. But in your experience, what do you think it takes to change that thinking? Because this is something I always struggle with. People will get reports, they see evidence, they see the models, like in the Netherlands, and then they come back and it's like, well, what can you do? Because it's going to cost, you know, X amount of dollars. So, you know, I don't expect you guys to have all the answers, but, you know, maybe... maybe for a couple of suggestions, you know, how do we start changing minds on this?
Well, I think, you know, you spoke a little bit about how, unfortunately, things have changed provincially there in Ontario. And, you know, I wouldn't say that BC is doing much better, but I think there needs to be a conversation being had between all levels of government. So federal, provincial, regional, and municipal. And really, if we start looking at the discussion in that, in all tiers of government, then maybe we can start recognizing that there is budget allocation that can be made. And if we're really going to talk about, you know, even on the federal level, if we're going to talk about creating more sustainable, clean ways of moving around our cities, then we need to recognize that the amount of investment that we're putting into these clean options, like walking and cycling, which are essentially, you know, aside from the infrastructure, pretty cheap options. You know, if we're not going to invest in that, then we're not going to see the results. But I think there also needs to be, you know, at a local level, the conversations between agencies to really push for that and finding the common ground. So, I mean, I was just talking to a colleague in Winnipeg who was talking about the school travel program they've developed in Manitoba. And part of that and the success of it involved talking with the Heart and Stroke Foundation and talking with local community groups to find that common ground to say, this is a benefit for our children, so why don't we invest in it? And, you know, in those cases, unfortunately, it's mainly nonprofit, but if, you know, we can really push as a group for these, to recognize the problem to begin with and the investment that needs to be made, that's at least a start. We're stuck sort of, I mean, we're here in BC, we're stuck fighting against Alberta over a pipeline, and our premiers are currently throwing their toys out of the stroller over it. But, you know, we all have common ground that we can find, and I think we can get there. We just need to keep challenging.
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who doesn't want their child to be able to walk or cycle to school. So, you know, it's so much of this conversation, people think that building bike lanes is about, you know, the fit males that are already on bikes, when it's really about that 90% of the population that don't already cycle but would like to more. You know, it really is when we build cities that are better for active transportation, they're just better cities, and everybody wins whether you choose to walk or cycle
or drive,
or drive for that matter.
Well, certainly if there's more less people driving, it's easier for the ones who still have to drive. Can I ask about political motives? Because you're going on this book tour, you're launching the book, and you're coming through here in Ontario, where all of our cities and towns are having an election this year. I know there's an election in Vancouver this year. Was that a consideration, that, you know, this is an advocacy book and you're advocating to an electorate who is deciding who they want in their local government?
I think that's more just a matter of perfect timing. we didn't actually realize it was that Ontario shared the same municipal election cycle as we did, but it's working out quite well in our favor. The idea behind the book was to write something that someone who gets it, we know that we exist in a bit of a bubble, but what we wanted is for this book to get outside of that bubble, and that somebody who is an advocate for cycling and for safer streets and better cities could hand it to a counselor who knows absolutely nothing about why this stuff is important, read it and understand at least some of the concepts behind it. So hopefully some of the people attend our talks and then subsequently buy the book and pass it on to somebody like that who needs to learn a little bit more about, you know, what the possibilities are.
How much, you know, you guys have been doing this for a while. How much have you been able to sort of change minds on this, just in terms of your own individual advocacy? You know, I'm sure you encounter your fair share of skepticism when you talk about, you know, improving cycling. A lot of people think it's, you know, it's a tree hugging thing, and, you know, cars rule. And, you know, I can think of someone pretty prominent in Ontario who thinks that. But in terms of your own success, how have you been able to sort of been successfully able to promote your message?
Well, the question of measuring our success is a fantastic one, and it's something we consistently struggle with, because we are very much, we deal with ideas and inspiration and trying to influence people rather than, you know, create a tangible product. And so, you know, we certainly feel like since we started Medacity and four and a half years ago now, we've really built a broad and diverse audience, and grown, that's grown very, very quickly, because we don't make cycling political. We don't make city building about a left or right issue. We don't focus on the negatives. We very much present a human compelling case that's positive, and I think people have really latched onto that, and therefore have helped spread our word. But it, you know, as far as tangible results, that's something we continue to struggle with. It's been quite tricky to put our finger on, you know, this happened because of us, or this is, you know, a Medacity inspired project.
But we do see, you know, just in terms of our work with local advocacy, we have seen the conversation shift over time. And I mean, we wouldn't take complete credit for that. There's been a lot of people working behind the scenes to help change the way people perceive multi-mobility. But, you know, I think along the same timeline, we've managed to connect with the right people and share some of these ideas, share ideas that are happening elsewhere. So, you know, for example, we're about to have, in September, we have a Bike the Night event. This will be our third year, but that was based off of an experience that Chris actually had in Montreal for the Tour de la Nuit, and bringing that idea here and just exposing people to things like that. And that's one of the great things about what we do, is we're able to share messages from everywhere. It's not so hyper-focused on one community or another. I mean, we certainly are grateful for, you know, Vancouver's transformation helping to give us a platform, but it's all about sharing those positive messages and what's really possible.
Chris made an interesting point in that you said, you know, you through your work try not to be political, but it just made me think, how does cycling become political? Because it feels like that happens, I don't want to say by accident, but it does feel like it's a byproduct in sort of talking about cycling, that if you are in favor of more cycling infrastructure, more active transportation, you are at one end of the spectrum. And if you are someone who's saying, well, we can't afford that, roads are for cars, then you're automatically at the other end of the spectrum. So I don't expect you to have a definitive answer, but, you know, in terms of that political attitude, you know, it seems like it's an artificial product of the debate, just by you know, people's points of view. It doesn't feel like a left-right issue, like something like the right to choose or something. It seems bizarre to me.
Yeah, I think that's just a product of cycling being so marginalized over the years, that it's considered a niche activity, and you know, when you do look at the numbers, I mean, conservatives should be all over invested in cycling because of the massive return on investments that it produces, and you know, how we heavily subsidize our automobile consumption, and how it, you know, utilizes massive parts of our all three levels of government, our budgeting. But, you know, I think you really know you've made it as a cycling city or a society when it no longer becomes a political issue. And that was one of the really cool things about going to the Netherlands, was learning how basically every politician, whether no matter what side of the spectrum you're on, you have to be considered pro-bike, because you just simply can't get elected. Now, that's a country that's been cycling for decades. But to a perhaps a more newer and relevant example, here in Vancouver, where the city's really only been giving this push towards on-street cycling facilities for the past 10 years. Well, we've now reached a point where most municipal councillors and mayoral candidates have to be pro-bike in order to get strongly considered to be a contender. So we've come a long way in just here in Vancouver in just 10 years from the mayoral candidates promising to rip out all the bike lanes to right now, at last count, probably 8 out of the 9 mayoral candidates, we've got a wide field this year, are in favor of expanding the bike network, which is pretty cool to see.
And the one I think that has gone against it has been pretty much been marked as like, well, why would you even do that? That's just
She's
absurd.
very much a fringe candidate, yes.
Yeah.
I love to live in a city where the fringe candidate is the one against bikes. It does seem to me that what has to happen then is sort of ingrain cycling in the culture. That sounds like what it is in the Netherlands. It's part of how you get around. It's not seen as something that you have to make the leap. You guys made the leap to going car light, although you're heading that way anyway. But I think in very much North America, it's a very conscious decision. Do I get on my bike or hop in my car? My car has air conditioning and I can get there faster. My bike has, I have to pedal in the heat. I have to, run through traffic. It seems like the battle is, if we can call it a battle, that the battle is a cultural shift and not just a political or a infrastructure one or a education one.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think we have pockets of it across North America where cycling is just part of the everyday. I think of my parents when we talk about like, oh, we're biking everywhere and we're considered fringe. And they grew up in Montreal and we're like, that's what we did. And that's kind of what they still do in Montreal. It's not, I mean, there's still politics behind it, but it's much more fine-grained in the culture of the city. And I think, one of the ways that we can get there is sort of start. It's one of the things that Chris and I really push for is getting away from this tribalism of like you're either a cyclist or a motorist. Because, whether you're in a car most of the time, at some point you're going to get out of that car and walk somewhere, and that you're not going to get out in the garage to your house and get out in the garage to your office and never step outside. And, if we just think of ourselves as all just people trying to get around and we're all just trying to make it as comfortable as possible. I think that will get us more to a place where it's a little more culturally normal to not always drive everywhere. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to get out of that mindset, especially when, the way our media operates, it's very much, if you post something about bike lanes, you're automatically going to get clicks. Or if you post something about like bikes versus cars, you're going to get clicks. And
Right.
it's the way media works. But if we can start shifting that a little bit, I think we can start seeing a cultural shift and remembering, as Chris pointed out earlier, that not everybody drives. Only people from the ages of 16 to, let's say 70. That's where more majority of your drivers are. But outside of those age ranges, like what about all of our kids? Do we politicize their movement? No, because they're kids, they can't drive. So let's start thinking about things more in that perspective as opposed to you're either a cyclist or a driver or you walk.
Right. Well, maybe to wrap up, I'll ask you guys to just sort of pitch what a cycling utopia might look like in sort of like the perfect world where you had all the money and the political will to do what you want. What does a really great city look like for cyclists in terms of, what do the roads look like? What's the attitude? And how does your perfect city work?
Yeah, I will never forget the first day we landed in Rotterdam, and the whole family, our 2 children and Melissa and I, got on bikes and started exploring the city. This was now 2 summers ago, but we're used to going to new cities and trying to orient ourselves and see the city by bike, and it usually involves a bike map and some kind of Google Maps. And going 2 or 3 blocks out of your way to get where you want to go and carefully mapping your route. And in Rotterdam, which again is probably one of the most car-centric cities in the Netherlands, we within 10 minutes we had thrown the map out and tucked the phones in our pockets because there was cycling infrastructure on virtually every street that we cycled on. And that got us directly from where we started to where we were going without having to check the map to make sure it was a bike route. So on arterial roads, it was fully separated from traffic. On the back streets, it was heavily traffic calmed so that there were barely any cars moving, and those that were going quite slow. And this really intuitive, seamless bike network that's probably a product of 50 years of careful planning and fighting was really kind of, to see that as the end product really blew our minds, to see that a city could function that way, not just for the tourists, but for the people who live there as well, and making the bicycle kind of their first choice for getting around, in fairly comfortable, and they're not having to worry about all kinds of safety gear or helmets or reflective clothing or mirrors. They're just hopping on a beat up old bike and tootling around their own city. And yeah, we very much continue to be inspired by what the Dutch have accomplished, and definitely think that if Rotterdam can do it, then virtually any city here in North America can accomplish the same thing.
And I think my version of utopia would be all of that. But I think it's more just the attitude and the qualitative for me. One of the things I remember, it has always stood out for me, is that there's no such thing as being a cyclist there. People are all just getting around. And I would love to live in a place where my act of getting on a bicycle to get to work or pick up my kids or go to the grocery store is no more eventful than if I had gotten into a car. And I don't have to worry about anyone judging me or yelling at me for being in their way, unless I'm being, unless you're being a total jerk about it. But to just be able to move around my city in the way that makes the most sense without having anybody think what I'm doing is remarkable or extraordinary would be my bicycle utopia.
Well, I think that sounds perfect. So, Chris and Melissa Brunlett, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
Cheers.
And once again, that was Chris and Melissa Bruntlett. Their book, Building the Cycling City, The Dutch Blueprint for Urban Vitality, comes out on August the 28th, and it's available now for pre-order from Island Press, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Indigo Books, and you can find the links to all those sources on the show notes page for this episode of the Politicast. Their book tour will take them through Guelph on August the 29th at the E-Bar, which will be hosted by the Guelph Coalition for Active Transportation. And you can learn more about the work of Chris and Melissa Bruntlett outside of their book at their website, modacitylife.com. That's modacitylife.com. And that's it for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics, Ed Sid Dale. The host of the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. You can reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can, of course, donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.